Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.
I'm referred to, you know, lovingly by some chefs as OG Koji because I am a OG Koji.
I am a Koji fanatic.
I have been for well over a decade now.
Live and on set at the IDM Content Kitchen. Dude, I cannot wait to just shoot the shit. We've been talking for literally the past 2 days about anything and everything. And I think a lot of it we need to bring on. Let people hear. Let them know about what we've been chatting about. And those that are watching with me in the Content Kitchen, Dustin Salvaggio, the chef, the maestro, he is a legend in his own right. So again, thanks for taking the time just to shoot this before you got to fly back out.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. It's been a great couple of days. I'm glad we're doing this because we've had some really provocative conversations around things that chefs are talking about, but there's not enough info out there. So let's kick it off.
Yeah, it's almost like they're kept secrets, but they're not, right? They're out there, but like in their own bubble, they're kept. And so I don't know, you want to talk Dre, do we want to go Koji? Do we want to talk about the industry as a whole? I mean, there are so many directions we could kick this off with.
Well, I mean, since we're on the subject, let's talk about the industry as a whole and how information gets from manufacturers to chefs. It goes through a network of dealers and reps. And factories really rely on reps to communicate their message to the dealers who then communicate it to the chefs. But what we're seeing nowadays is a revolution in how that communication's happening, and it's going direct to the chef from the factories through social media engagement, through these podcasts that we're doing. Yeah. So this is a really exciting time for me because I'm an information guy. I'm a teacher by trade, and I like when the information is readily available and easy to digest, and we're actually able to do that now and get in front of the chefs through this wonderful podcast. But we talked about dry aging this week. And I think this is a very important topic because we've seen a growth in the dry aging industry in America. A lot more restaurants that weren't doing it before are doing it now because of some of the technologies out there. And you guys have, in my opinion, the best set it, forget it dry aging system available on the market. I've tested quite a few of them, tasted the products out of them. And to be honest, up until you had sent me a sample a couple weeks ago, I was really reluctant to put my stamp of approval on any of the dry aging systems out there because, unfortunately, they don't produce a lot of the characteristics that you get from traditional dry aging. There's not that nuttiness, that funkiness, that aroma. They make a tender meat. They make a more dry aged meat. It looks pretty in the dining room. But at the end of the day, the qualities that we look for that really set a dry aged steak apart from a regular steak just aren't there. They're lacking. But now we have the Meatico's, and I'll tell you what, I'm blown away by this technology, not just in its design and the beauty of it, but the simplicity of it and how to use it. And ultimately, the best part about it is the results. This is the first set and forget dry aging system that I've seen that you can put a piece of meat in there and 30 to 40 days later, get a perfectly dry aged meat with those characteristics. I think it's amazing.
So. Well, and for someone, that's not my background, right? The people that have listened know. I didn't come from fine dining. I didn't do this type of stuff. I was in institutions, right? And dry aging, what is that, right? Yeah. You know about it, but not a lot about it. And when it was like, hey, you need to now figure out how to do marketing for a dry aging cabinet. I'm like, okay. So, you know, typical fashion, the technology, there's so much out there, right? It's read books, find information, and just playing with it. It was just so easy, intuitive. So the learning curve wasn't that difficult, which is what was great for me because it wasn't, oh my God, I really have to dial this thing in. It was kind of like, here's the baseline parameters, throw a piece of meat in it, especially on the actual meat cabinet, and then let it do its magic. Yeah. And I was blown away by, I can just throw it in there and just let it go. And then now getting into fish, and again, that is in and of itself a whole nother ball game of the airflow, and you know, you don't want pellicles and you don't want mold, and figuring that out, and that we have a dedicated cabinet to it. It's just, it's crazy. So it's for someone who didn't do it a lot, you know, those guys have been doing this for a long time, but someone who hasn't, it's been great and easy to figure out how to use the cabinets.
Well, that's, I mean, I think that's the selling point of any of these cabinets, no matter which brand, you know, we're discussing, is the ease of use. Most of them are easy to use. But, you know, there's going too far down the path of making it too simple for the user. And I think that a lot of the competition that's out there falls into that category of they're trying to make it so set and forget that they take away a lot of the characteristics from the process that are needed to be there. Or they try to make one unit do five jobs that one unit physically by the laws of science can't do, right? And that, to me, that's, you know, not just that it produces the characteristics, but Medico has actually taken the steps to say, no, you can't do all dry aging in one environment. You need multiple environments, and each type of dry aging has its own parameters to follow. So they've built out, what, four different cabinets now? There's a meat cabinet. Yep. There's a fish cabinet, all with their own proprietary programs to run those products. You have a wine storage cabinet from this company. And then we also have a multi-use cabinet, which is cheese production, charcuterie production. Yeah. You can't find that in the competition out there. They are all saying you can put one, you know, cabinet in your restaurant and do all of these things. And what the feedback is that I've been getting from a lot of my chef friends in the industry is it doesn't do it, right? It does it close enough that, you know, from the marketing side of things, it can get in the doors. But when the chef then has to take those products and sell them to their customers, there's a little bit of buyer's remorse, right? They don't understand why the messaging doesn't align with the final product. And that's really, I think, a strength of Medico. It's like you can get the product that's needed to do get the results that you're trying to get.
Well, what I also didn't realize, like the charcuterie and cheese need the water connection.
Yes.
Nobody else has water. And it's like, well, when you start reading about it, because again, that's not my wheelhouse, but you start reading and digging into it, you're like, oh yeah, you do need a different environment. Mm. You do need actual moisture, humidity added back to it for some of those mold growths.
Yeah.
And it didn't really hit me. I was like, well, that makes a lot of sense why you'd have a dedicated cabinet just for that versus everything in one and hoping and relying on the natural humidity of the product to do with everything.
Well, you bring up a good point there, the mold in dry aging. So the stance of a lot of the competition that I've heard and been exposed to is they're trying to eliminate all molds. And from a safety standpoint, health board standpoint, that's great, right? And that makes your job a little bit easier with the health departments. But the molds are what make those characteristics possible. So it's not a matter of eliminating the molds. It's a matter of mitigating the molds, managing the molds that are good and eliminating the ones that are bad. And that is where Medico really shines, because it allows for that natural mold growth. Mm-hmm. And for anybody out there that's not familiar with the mold in food, it's good, it's safe, it's healthy, as long as you're using the right molds.
Right.
And, you know, I'm referred to, you know, lovingly by some chefs as OG Koji, because I am a Koji fanatic. I have been for well over a decade now. I've been involved in development projects on Koji cabinets, growing materials. I'm even involved in one of the best houses in Japan that grows Koji spores. We're developing different strains to fit the Western market. And growing mold is extremely tricky and difficult to get the results you want, because it's a living organism. So the conditions have to match up. Now, if you have a cabinet that's dry aging and it's dedicated to just the moisture evaporation on the meat, and they're not paying attention to the moisture needed during the growth of the mold and establishing that, you can run into these complications where the characteristics don't develop. What I'm seeing with Medico, and something I'm really excited to test, is that multi-use cabinet you talked about that has the water line, it has humidity control in it. Looking at the temperatures and the variables, we should be able to grow Koji in it. So not only could we produce straight Koji in these cabinets as a Koji growing medium, but we can introduce Koji onto the products that we're dry aging, and all in one closed environment that's safe. That is something that doesn't exist that I know of. And as far as growing cabinets for just Koji itself, you've got to go into the laboratory world to get something that really works for large volume, and that's tens of thousands of dollars that most restaurants don't have to invest. So looking at this option, it's half the price as a laboratory equipment model, and you can grow perfect Koji, hopefully. I mean, we're going to test it out to make sure, But that opens up a whole new world to dry aging that is not possible with other units, which is amazing for me.
And it takes out some steps because I started reading Koji Alchemy. Koji Alchemy. Yeah. You mentioned it. For those that don't know, this is our third round. Round one got X because no video. Second round we published. Third round's now in person. So, but you had mentioned it to me, and so I started reading, and it truly is fascinating when you actually read about what is going on, about the enzymatic processes. I mean, obviously you can go in so much more depth than I can. But then I started, I literally instantly was like, why am I not doing that with the beef? And then I started reading, I'm like, okay, well, we got to get the spores, and then we'd have to kind of like rub it on it and let it kind of grow. It was like, do I even want to attempt to go down this rabbit hole and ruin a, you know, for just testing purposes?
Exactly.
I was like, maybe I'll wait till I talk to Dustin again.
And there's also that fear that's naturally there with all fermentation, because I mean, what is fermentation at the end of the day? It's controlled decay. And if you don't control it properly, people can get sick and die. And we know that for millennia. We've been warned about it in our pop culture and our cooking recipes, and we learn about it in school. Our whole HACCP system exists because of controlling that process, right? So that is a fear and a concern that is keeping people from really understanding the magics that exist in fermentation. And what I'm noticing is chefs want to ferment. They want to grow koji. They're just scared of how to get into it. And the stakes are really high because no chef wants to make somebody sick or kill them. Right. That's a career ender, right? It's a mental health ender for a chef if you got somebody that sick. So I think us working in the technology section of this industry, it's our job to kind of work with these companies to make something that meets in the middle for everybody. Safety, but also gives you the qualities safely that you're looking for. This is a cabinet that does it. And just to go off on a sidestep for people that are unfamiliar with koji is a mold. It is applied directly to a product. Usually it's cut with another starch because the starch acts as sort of a food or a growing medium for the koji to feed off of and take root. But that koji has to grow in a very humid and very warm environment. Koji originated in Asia, in the jungles of Asia. So in order to grow that mold to where it's actually effective, you have to have high temperatures and high humidity, which don't align with health protocols.
Right.
So we need these tools to kind of do that. And the beauty of koji and why people are using it is you're not growing koji to eat koji straight. You can. It adds dynamic qualities to a dish if you incorporate it correctly. Like I was in Thailand a couple months ago, and there's a chef there who is a koji fermentation fanatic. And I specifically went to Thailand to visit this restaurant and see this guy's work. And he was making taco tortilla shells out of koji, straight koji. And that was the medium for the taco shell. Phenomenal experience. The texture was great. It was like a beautifully homemade flour tortilla, but it had all these dynamic umami notes and sweetness from the simple sugar breakdown in the rice that was used to grow the taco shell. Like, it added five layers of depth and complexity to a taco shell.
Yeah, so was he growing the koji on the rice and then grinding that up?
No, so he was taking the rice and creating a paste, or a film, essentially, and then inoculating that with the koji and allowing it to grow.
Okay.
So furthermore, into the koji kind of thing is, you can eat it straight, like I was saying, but really we're using koji because what koji does as it grows is it produces an incredible amount of enzymes, mainly amylase, which breaks down carbohydrates and sugars, and protease, which breaks down proteins. And what those enzymes do is, I tell my students, is you're adding the enzymes to the dish because they're basically the prep team of chefs that get to it before your chefs get to it. They are microscopic chefs, and what they're doing is they're cleaving those complex strands of carbohydrates into simple sugars. They're cleaving the aminos into glutamates. Like, where you're getting these really rich, complex flavor notes out of your food before you even touch it. The mold does all the work for you. But that requires some knowledge, right? Like, because each strain of koji you use, whatever the substrate or medium you grow it on, and whatever temperature you grow it at, humidity levels, all affect the production of enzymes and, you know, what amount of protease comes out of it, what amount of amylase. And those are the keys to this fascinating culture around Koji is like there are so many variables that you can play with, mm-hmm. and so many ways that you can create your own flavor identity in your restaurant with this one ingredient. And I think that's why chefs are really flocking to it. I've seen such an uptick in Koji. Personally, my DMs are flooded constantly with questions on Koji, how to grow it, where to get equipment, where to source the spores. So it's not something that's dying anytime soon. I actually think it's like flour in the kitchen at this point. It's a staple. Everybody's going to be using it in a few years in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. Of, is it going to stay in, as people think, the higher echelon, nice fine dining? No. Or is it, you know, how is it going to leak its way into middle of the road? Obviously it's probably never going to make its way down into mom and pop. It's possible. I'm not saying it can't happen, but more that mid tier where, you know, the average person is going to go out to eat and be like, oh, this is something I never thought of. How do you see it working its way into that?
I think it's going to take the natural path that most food technologies and techniques take, which is, like you said, it starts in the higher echelon where chefs have resources, teams, and products to play around and research and develop food. So a lot of the food development that happens in the world not only happens in commercial settings like Nabisco research facilities and, you know, Tyson research facilities, those food scientists are aimed at profit potential of the food. So it's not really about nutrition. It is about flavor because you have to hit upon key flavor points to make people crave your product. But it's more about profit in that world. And then you have the Michelin kitchens with the research labs and these high-end, maybe they're not even Michelin rated, but fine dining restaurants where it's craft cooking going on. That's where you see a lot of experimentation. And it's also where you see a lot of filtering out of techniques and things that are coming into the scene. But what happens from that point is the Michelin kitchens and the higher upper echelon, they do all of the mistakes, they fall on their face, and they end up codifying this technique or technology into something that the whole world of food can understand. Mm. That's what gets passed on. And then it gets further distilled down till it gets to the chains and the mom and pops where there can't be a lot of complicated work that is involved. It's got to be as simple as possible. And where I see Koji coming down the strain is those high-end institutions will continue to grow and experiment and play and discover the magic of Koji. But what you're going to see in the middle of the road is you're going to see, in my prediction, Koji houses popping up where there are businesses that just grow blocks of Koji and sell them to restaurants. So that whole guesswork is taken out of it. And then furthermore, I see things like the shoyus and the misos and the soy sauces and the garums and these flavorful liquids, the shio kojis. I see those as being staples that filter to all parts. And shio is already there, but the current state of Koji in America and the Western world is it's an ambiguous purchasing experience for the most part. Unless you're juiced in, you know, with contacts in Japan like I have, or you know Michelin starred chefs or chefs that are getting these pure strains, it's next to impossible to get a strain that's pure and a strain from a reputable source. Typically what we buy is these bulk versions of Koji that are dried already on the grains, and you get them, you reconstitute them, grow them, whatever. Or you can get powders, and again, unless you know the source, you don't know if it's reputable, right?
Because they're all over Amazon. Like I just did quick Google, on the internet just to see what's out there and what's available. I mean, literally Amazon, you can get Koji, like it's literally in a little vial. And but to your point,
you don't know what strain
it is. How reputable is that? What am I getting myself into?
And that's a big concern that I've always had for Koji. There's a lot of different molds in the world, and there's only a small amount of them that are Koji, and even a smaller amount of that family that's like safe to eat, right? And unless you know, there could be dangers in that. Like I have personally bought stuff off of Amazon in my early days of Koji growing where I grew it and it had multiple types of mold growing. It wasn't one strain. That's scary to me because you don't know what those other molds are, and some can be cancer causing or, you know, genetically debilitating to your system or something, you know, some sort of health concern, you know, some can be toxic essentially. So I've always been a purist in like knowing my ingredients, knowing where they come from, And I've been lucky enough to work in upper echelon kitchens and have some contacts that turned me on to a Koji house in Japan that is the oldest and most famous. They're the Gucci of Koji growing, right? They have the best product, and they have a team of scientists who are constantly developing and unlocking different strains and magic in the Koji world. So I recommend, and my advice is, don't ever trust the Amazon products unless they have a provenance with them. You know where they're being grown, what strain it is, because the strain matters. There is, Koji is not just one strain. It's a family of Aspergillus oryzae, and it has many different versions in there. There's black ones, there's white ones, there's green ones, there's one that grow sour notes, there's one that grow floral notes, there's one that have lots of protease, ones that have lipase, which breaks down fats. Like, there's all different types of strains, and you know, it depends on what you need it for. But at the end of the day, when you're buying from a place like that, you know it's safe,
right?
You know it's vetted, you know it's grown in a certified facility, you know, that's hermetically sealed, so everything is clean, there's no contamination, and that's really important with something like this, because we're growing living things,
right?
And I think humans are starting to, like, we think we're gods of nature, but nature still owns us, right?
It's so funny you say that, because the last person I talked to, we talked about how, I'm like, how are we going to advance and keep progressing? And he goes, I actually think it's the reverse. I think things are going back to the way they were. And that is the advancement, because we've gotten so far in the tech and everything has become so synthetic that people are like, okay, enough is enough. Let's get back to, you know, the food that it was and why it was so good and nutritious and mm-hmm. the whole nine yards. And I really pondered on that for a while. I was like, that makes a hell of a lot of sense. Well, a lot of these practices were going back to what, you know, it's almost like fashion, right? Things cycle themselves.
Always, yeah.
Obviously it's a much faster cycle, but I think food is kind of going to do the same thing.
Agreed.
With where we were.
But the beauty of that, and another thing I touch on in my class, is the evolution of the dining industry, food service industry as a whole. And like where we've gone and where we're going, kind of thing, to give my students an idea of like what's out there for career paths. And I touch upon this. Sorry, I'm going to move this because I keep hitting it. So I touch upon this because it's very important. And that is an incredible point that you bring up. I'm a perfect example of it. So I grew up classically trained, went to culinary school, spent a lot of time in Italian and French kitchens, learning the classical techniques from a classical brigade with an asshole chef who was abusing us, right? Like, that was just the way it was. We knew that what we were getting into. I did a lot of free time staging at restaurants. That's all changing, right? After I was going through that, in my 20s, I was exposed to food science in a big way. I worked in a major food lab across seas. And while working there, I became highly specialized in food science, food technology, and all these like really expensive, crazy things, all in the quest of making these really modernist dishes. The foams, the caviars, the bubbles, the vapors, the essences, the reverse spherification, all of those things that you saw blowing up everywhere mm-hmm. with the Bali movement and Alinea and all these places. That was a needed movement. And I'm glad that I went through that, because that movement, it was obnoxious because everybody was putting caviar and bubbles and things that aren't needed or really took away from dishes, I think, on plates, just because it was a cool technique that they learned how to do and they wanted to show off. And that molecular gastronomy, and I hate that terminology, molecular gastronomy, but that period of time in food was needed because it taught us all the things that were mysterious to chefs for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
Like I literally worked in a kitchen where a chef made us make all the risotto with one wooden spoon that he had and he kept in his drawer, because in his mind, that was a magic wooden spoon that made the best risotto. He didn't know why. He couldn't explain why, but that was the spoon we all had to use. He was Italian.
Okay, makes sense.
So that was the spoon he had to use, but he could never explain why. It was just this mystical theory and faith that he had. And that was chefs back in the day. We were shown how to do something. We know it worked right. And sometimes we put a superstitious tie to it, like that wooden spoon, or we just accepted it as, this is law. If I do it exactly this way, it turns out exactly this way. We didn't know why. We didn't understand anything about why. Some of us did. But But that movement, the molecular gastronomy, broke us away from that, black book culture of you have to give me your life to get my IP on this recipe. So now chefs are awake. We know what's going on in food. We know the chemistry behind mixing ingredients together and why it reacts the way it does. We understand the forces of nature and the physics happening on our stovetop now, so we can better control the cooking process. But coming all the way back, long story long, coming back to the point, original point is, all of those chefs that I know, for the most part, we've all now gone to the primal cooking techniques, but we put it on a foundation of science now. And I think that's going to show us an even more beautiful way to eat in the future, because nobody can argue that the classics are the classics for a reason. They hit all the points, right? They excite us to eat. They create memories. They, you know, form bonds. They blow your mind when you eat a great dish like Wellington, any of those classics that you can think of. That they're staples on menus all around the world for a reason. Humans love them. That's the tradition of cooking. That's the primal cooking, the cooking over charcoal. Like, I mean, that's probably the oldest cooking technique we have other than dehydration, right? Or maybe even fermentation were the two oldest cooking techniques. But we're all going back to that now because it's almost like, okay, we learned the really complicated stuff of how to do this. Well, let's go back to the roots and figure out why the roots work. You know, like figure out why those dishes are impactful and how can I make them better? Mm-hmm. Or how can I improve them to my taste or my operation? And you're seeing a lot of this now. You know, you may go to a restaurant and you could get a rack of ribs, but you don't realize that rack of ribs is no longer just thrown on a pit by a smoke master and marinated a certain way. It's going through sous vide. It's going through combi ovens. It's going through pressure cooking. Maybe it's going, you know, it's going through cold smoking. It's, you know, maybe the barbecue sauce was thickened with Ultratecs instead of just a natural barbecue. Like there's all these little things coming into play that are just, it's making our food better. In making it we now know how to make things cleaner and healthier by using different ingredients. It's making it easier to produce. So that toxic work culture is starting to dissipate because it doesn't have to be so stressful anymore. I don't have to scream at you a million times to cook a steak, right? I could just have you put in a sous vide tank and know that if you can grill it and put a mark on it, we're good. So it's, I think there's an evolution going on, but you know, to answer your question at the end, like, or to address that point you brought up, like this is a very powerful time of food and we're going to see the classics elevated to a place that humans never thought they could be. We're going to see sustainability come to the forefront because people are obnoxiously wasting food and they're realizing it now and they're starting to use this science and understanding to find ways around that and utilize those products. For instance, Matt Orlando, when he was at Amas and he still does this recipe, he uses the fish bones. So he'll take fish, butcher it, take the bones, make a stock for ramen broth, and then take those bones and pressure cook them into a paste and make the noodles for the ramen out of it. So there is zero waste on the dish. If he didn't understand how pressure cooking works and he didn't understand the additives needed to bind it up, like the methacellulose or whatever, and he didn't, that would never happen. But what's he making in the end? Ramen. So to the consumer, it's a great classic ramen bowl of noodles. But to the chef, it's a very complicated process. And to the industry, it's something that's needed to go forward in that next step.
Yeah, so. We were talking earlier about it. There's a gentleman down in Florida, Reed, he just opening a place called Rest of the Fish. And that's his whole premise is how do we take, after they're cleaned and everyone wants the pretty fillets and they might use the head for stock, what do you do with the rest of the fish? And he's utilizing that and he's cooking down and pulling out all the meat off of those bones. And then how do you utilize those bones? He's using the entire thing. And I'm just like, man, that is so smart because he's got some tag and it's like, you know, the best way to reduce like overfishing and all the things that we want to change in the industry is by just utilizing the whole animal like they did back in the day, right? You know, you think about it, you're in America, right? The bison. There was a reason there was so many of them because the entire animal got used.
Everything.
Hide, bones. I mean, there was not a speck of that animal that did not get used.
Yeah. I mean, well, I've kind of dissected this, right? Just personally, because I'm interested in food culture, obviously, and like how it progresses. And you're right. Food, for longer than it hasn't been, has been a sustainability mission, right? Like people could not afford to waste food ever. So you have these dishes that are literally just pure necessity dishes like bouillabaisse. Bouillabaisse started because it was all the byproduct and catch. That was your seafood. So you threw in a pot with some flavorful tomatoes, fennel, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you had this beautiful stew at the night with all the fish that you couldn't sell at the market. So the fishermen were eating great, but they weren't eating the prime cuts, you know? And then we got to this point. I've identified it as post-World War II. So World War II, we saw an incredible event that involved the entire world and everybody was pretty much in the same situation. Mm-hmm. All the world's economies were funding a war. They weren't funding the population. So people in America just came out of a Great Depression at that point. So there was no food to be had other than what you could grow in your gardens, right? And we had freedom gardens here in America where even the government was telling people, grow your own food, offset the war cost. You know, that was the whole propaganda marketing around it. And we had this culture where people were going back to producing their own food and they were getting back to it. Well, then all the soldiers came home. We won the war. It was a period of prosperity and peace. And what did we see happen in our culture, food culture during that time? We saw big food companies coming up. And the messaging didn't become any more about do your part to feed yourself and have this great food commune going on. It came to go out and work, go out and spend money, go out and live your life to the fullest because we just got done dodging a bullet in a world war. Like, live your life. And here's all these companies with TV dinners and Betty Crocker cake mixes and all these things that were made to make our lives easier so that we can enjoy our lives, but also eat what we wanted to eat and eat better maybe than we were used to eating with very minimal work. That was a cool mission, I think. But it also led to the problems we're seeing nowadays with the obesity and the health crisis because corporations, they don't work for the common good of man. They work for profit. This is a capitalist society. So I think those companies lost sight along the way of making it too convenient, too easy. And when they unlocked that easiness, then it became into how do we make it more profitable for us? And that's when we started seeing really highly engineered foods and dirty labels and, you know, all these synthetic materials and things coming into our products and this disposable packaging and just all the things that are wrong with our food system these days, I think came out of that movement where it was supposed to be something pure and good. The good thing about that, though, is that's where all the food science came from. That's where we started unlocking the mysteries of food and understanding these special additives and preservation techniques and all this stuff. And now all of these things exist because of that movement. But, you know, we're getting to a point now where we have to really push the gas on that. Yeah. Right?
The evil was outweighing the good. You know, there was still good in it that came out of it. And I don't want to go down the political spectrum, but like with what's going on now and what they're trying to clean up, and you see the dyes are being removed and how the big companies are now. Yeah. It's funny, right? Europe, they already do it. Canada, they already do it. But to their own people, they're like, nah, they're dumb. Let's just keep feeding them all the crap and they're going to keep buying it. But now you're seeing them saying, like, they're coming out with laws, right? Dyes are being banned as in 20—it's funny, though, the time spans. End of 2026, it's like, you know you could run and have them be out by the end of the year like that.
Yeah.
But let's give them a runway. What are your thoughts on that as far as, like, where that's going? Do you think it'll continue? Do you think the general public's going to keep pushing and saying, clean up the food?
Yeah, and you know, it's hard to talk anything politically involved because we all have our views, and obviously this isn't a politics forum. You know, we're talking about food here, but politics affects our food. And my personal opinion on it is, it will last. You know, this is something that the public and the communities of America have wanted since the 80s. We saw it with the farm to table movement being pushed and it forcefully pushed because there were a lot of communities and companies trying to shut it down and commoditize farming and bankrupt farmers so that only farmers work for big companies and not for local communities. And I was in the restaurant scene relatively soon after that whole farm to table movement started. And I met nothing but flack. You know, it was hard to get off the ground with farm to table until the late 90s, you know, early 2000s. That's when it started to catch on. So that culture and that mindset of wanting to eat healthy has been there. People want it. But if you live in a society where corporations have more pull on process and procedure and how things are produced, you're never going to realize that goal because they have the money blocking it, right? And that's what we were facing for a very long time. And we still are. There are, what, 5 or 6 major food companies that dominate 90% of what we eat in America. So I think we're getting away from that. I love the changes that are coming and the laws that are banning these ingredients, because I frequent Europe a lot with my job. And I eat all the bad stuff in Europe because it tastes so damn good. And I never feel bad. I'm never lethargic. I've lost weight from that diet. But you eat the same things in America and your health goes down the crapper real fast. So it's a needed thing. And I think the populace is going to push it to its end goal, which is needed. Like, we're the only country in the world that suffers from the obesity rates and the health problems that we suffer from. And it's not like we're just eating this crazy diet that nobody else eats. We have the most eclectic diet in the world. We have every culture in the world represented in our restaurants. So there's no reason we should be as overweight and obese as we are. But, you know.
Well, I'm going to go down the journey. I didn't know until you had said it a little bit yesterday and today about your journey, even with weight loss and where you were at, even just 2 years ago. When I saw that picture, I was like, there is no way that's him.
Yeah. And what, I mean, I carried it well, so yeah.
And what you did to transform that, and then how you feel, and again, getting over that, like you said, that hump, maybe just that story of your doctor, physician, whoever it was, nutritionist, it was like, just get through it and it's going to change your life.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this on the air. I was 280 pounds, almost 300 pounds. I was going through not just the weight problems of my health. I'm a chef, right? I grew up in Michelin kitchens and I'm Italian, so I grew up in Nonna's kitchen, fat little Italian kid, right? Like, I was always chubby. And then going to the chef world, I had access to these extremely nutrient-dense, caloric foods. And it, like most chefs, it gets away from you, right? Because we eat because it's our career. So we eat to study. We eat to develop. We eat to calm our nerves. Like, a lot of it's stress eating, right? So it gets away from you easy as a chef. And for me, it got away from me. And I used to be a gym nut for a while there. And I had actually gotten like very muscular and like in shape right before my son was born. And then I opened a restaurant relatively soon after my son was born. So like no time, right? It was either see my son for a little bit in the morning or go to the gym. So I made the choice to see my son and run my restaurant. And that's when I saw my weight really climb. I went from around 200 pounds up to 280 in a couple of years. And I didn't realize it. Nobody realizes it when you get that big. I mean, you know you're big, right? You feel it, but you just push through because your body adapts and you get used to carrying that weight. But I started facing some health issues from other factors like stress of the industry and just things that you go through. And I had other health things happen that cued me off to my doctors basically all sitting me down and saying, I thought I was dying of cancer. I lost all my hair, like fell out from stress and all this stuff. And I'm going to doctors trying to find answers. Like, am I dying? Do I have cancer and stuff? And they're like, well, we need to run tests before we give you any sort of prognosis because we think we know what it is, but like, let's go through the tests. Mm-hmm. I went through all the tests, the sleep tests, numerous blood tests, stress tests, everything. And it came back. It was stress related and my weight. You know, and I had the talk from my family doctor who's known me since I was a little guy. And he told me, he's like, do you want to be around with your family or do you want like 10 more years? Because that's what you're looking at. Like, your body has done a huge decline in the past 2 years. He showed me my charts and like how everything was rising, my cholesterol, my hormone, everything was out of control. Wow. So that, I mean, it was a really rough time in my life to lose my hair and go through that, but I'm glad I did because it opened my eyes to like, your health is more important than, you can never put your health on the back burner. You have to really focus on it. So I knuckled down, went to a nutritionist, you know, got on a program, started working on the diet mainly, like portion sizes is a big part of it, right? In America, we're conditioned that it is a ripoff if you don't have a meal for now that fills you 3 times more than you should eat and leftovers for tomorrow.
Yep.
So like, we have this like go big or go home, oh, supersize me culture that's been going on since the 80s, right? And you grow up in it, you don't realize it. So yeah, I've managed my portion sizes and The original part of my diet was like really limited, brothy, high, you know, calorie broths, bone broths, vegetables, minimal proteins at that point. And like there was a point where I wanted to give up, right? Like I'm a chef. I want to eat burgers. I want to eat smoked meats and, you know, like dry aged meats. I live for those experiences, even though I've had like foie gras a million times. I still love that bite of foie gras after it comes out of the pan. You know, like I'm an addict. So, like, as you're going through this journey, it's very hard and you're breaking your bad habits. That's all you can think about, man. I was telling you, like, mine was in the morning, and I'm not a breakfast person, never have been, but I was craving these giant, like, English breakfasts and Waffle House breakfast when I was going through it. And, like, I remember going to the doctor, I was like, I'm gonna give up. Like, I can't do it. I need food. And she was like, just push through. Like, I promise you, your body knows the score and it'll tell you when it's ready. And then you'll never have to worry about it again, as long as you don't creep up on your calories and your portion sizes. And she was right. There was one day I remember waking up and I didn't have the craving for breakfast. And I was like, I'm actually craving like a light lunch today. Like, I don't feel right. Like, I'm a little, what I thought was nausea was just my body was like, no, you're full. Like, you don't need any more food. So, to be honest, I just eat a European diet now. Like, I eat no breakfast. I have maybe nibble black coffee. And then for lunch, I eat a pretty heavy lunch. And that's my usually my largest meal where I eat the carbs and the rich things. No snacking during the day, really. And then at night, I eat my dinner. And my dinner is an average portion size. Instead of 8 to 12 ounces of meat, I'm eating around 5 to 6 ounces of meat, right? And very minimal carbs. I usually try to load up on veg and then have that small portion of the carbs to, you know, enjoy. But it's, you know, it was a life-changing thing because now I'm down to like 190. I lost almost 100
Yeah,
pounds at
you
this
look
point.
great.
Yeah,
Like,
thanks, man.
just
Yeah, that pitch, don't put
from
that
that
picture.
picture, from that picture to that, I was like, no way. Hey, but to your point, I same thing. You know, even though somebody's smaller, right? I'm not the biggest structurally built guy. I'm tall.
You're very tall.
But it's the same thing, right? For my structure, I should be a lot heavier. And people don't understand that just because you look small doesn't mean that you're healthy. Like
Oh,
they're two
yeah,
different things. And people don't understand.
exactly.
They're like, oh, it must be nice. Must be nice. And I'm like, you don't understand that it's the same battle because you are smaller than you think you're supposed to be. And when you eat shit, you feel like shit.
Yeah.
And when I started removing a lot of that crap out of my diet and eating just good pork, to your point, it's all about portion sizes and getting your st honestly your stomach size down to where it needs to be. Right? There's a reason they went through the whole, you know, lap band system to shrink down how much you can
Yeah.
eat. It's to get your stomach smaller. And then when you pair that with nutrient dense food, that's high quality, right? The meat that I
Has to
eat,
be high quality,
when it's high quality, you don't. Like yesterday, you know, we had those beautiful 43-day dry-aged
Wow, those are
steaks
good.
that we did.
Yeah.
I only needed like four pieces
Yeah.
and a little bit of the crackling, and I was like full.
Yeah.
I ate a tiny little bit of salad, and
Yeah.
I don't crave any more food.
And that's a good point that you bring up. A lot of people don't understand that during that engineering process of food development that happened in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they took out a lot of nutrients from those foods. And like our body knows, right? We're genetically programmed to digest and take on certain nutrients from certain foods. And if you like longer in our evolutionary cycle, we were monkeys in the savanna grazing on things that were available. And then after that, when we became Homo sapiens, we were traveling around with herds of animals that we ate, and we knew the seasons to eat and that. So if you think about a diet like that, where our body has evolved with that diet, and then you go from that to I can have all the sugar and all the carbs I want, which in nature, carbs and sugar are rare. They're extremely rare. And that's the reason our bodies crave it. Because when you're out in nature as that monkey on the savannah hunting for a meal and you see a hive of honey, your body says, take those stings because that honey's got more nutrients in it and more calories in it and more vitamins and sugar and everything that you want that'll keep you going for a long time because you didn't know when you had your next meal coming, right? And our food scientists kind of played on that. Like we figured out those evolutionary triggers. Salts. Salts are rare. We crave salt. Sugar's rare. We crave sugar. Smoke on a fire is the oldest cooking technique. So when we smell smoke on meat, we want it. These are all things that they've programmed into our foods, right? And it makes you crave things that are neutrally devoid of anything, right? Like the snack foods that you get in a grocery store have no nutrients in them. No. There's next to nothing there for you other than empty calories. That paired with good marketing campaigns from the food companies and this cultural identity around certain foods, like people think that that's food and you live off of that. I always tell people, you shouldn't even go to the grocery store if you don't have to. Go to a specialized butcher for your meats. Go to a fishmonger if you have one for your fish. Go to a farm or a farmer's market for your vegetables, because those people are growing it for the quality of the product and the nutrition of the product. They're sourcing it for that same reason. Grocery stores are looking for the highest margin they could sell you at stuff. And if you live in an area that you don't have any of those things and you only have a grocery store, I tell people, stay away from the center of the grocery store. Yep. Stick to the outside, because the outside's all the fresh products that are natural and everything inside is engineered, and it's going to lead to these empty, devoid things. And it's like, I've never done heroin or drugs like that, but to me, I always think of those snack foods like that. You know, if you're going to do them, they're going to be good. It's going to feel good. You're going to enjoy that time eating it, but it's going to kill you. Yeah. It will kill you. One day, it may be a slow death, but it will kill you.
Yeah, pay now or pay later. I mean, that's the slogan. I always keep in the back of the head when it's like, hey, and dude, when you cut them out, you don't crave them.
No.
I was talking, again, someone the other day, and I said, you know what's really interesting? After I get done with dinner, I want 2 dried fruit bars that are just apples and mangoes, or apples and blueberries. Like, it's those bars. And those are the 2 ingredients. That's it.
Yeah.
It's dried fruit. It gives me just a little bit at the end to finish filling me, but then I get enough sweetness that it fills. And I'm like, I don't want cookies and candy and cakes. And I'm not saying I don't splurge everywhere.
Yeah, of course. Everybody
we're
does.
Human, right? Yeah. Like, nobody's perfect. But for the majority of the time, I don't sit there and crave and be like, man, I just want to eat carbs and sugary snacks. Once you cut it out, right? It's that first two weeks where you're just, oh man, it's right there.
Mine was like 2 months. It was rough.
Yeah.
But like, you're right. When you get past that point where your body is craving those bad things, it doesn't crave it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. Like, and to your point, like, we had the pizza today. We ordered pizza, beautiful pizza. I was like looking at it, like, I wanted it. I took 2-3 bites. I'm like, I'm full. I've had enough of this, because it was too rich. My body doesn't want that fatty, rich stuff anymore. Yep. It wants protein. It wants vegetables. It wants fermented foods. I've done a lot of fermentation work, so like, I love fermented products, and I always feel better after them.
Yeah. You know? Plus, we had a couple bison burgers, you know, cooked up.
Oh, those were good. Yeah.
Couple of those will always help it out.
But it's lean meat. It's healthy meat.
It is healthy meat. Yeah. It's really good. Like, I've had bison, but like, being able to take it to the next level, like, I can't wait. I get my hands on some boar. We're going to do some elk. Like, we're going crazy on the wild game train just to see what can be done, what can't be done, where the limitations, you know, things say, don't go past 14 because you just don't know, because being wild.
Like, we're going to 20.
We're going at least 30, at least 30, right? You need the enzymatic process to happen. Even if there's a little bit of intramuscular fat for those enzymes to break down properly, you got to get at least past 28.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I read about fish, because originally I was like, something small. I got a couple of Branzinos in there. I was like, oh, it's like going to be like 7 days. And then I heard a couple of the dry age, you know, people in that space and fish said, they're like, no, you got to get at least 14 in for the same type of process to happen to actually have a flavor development change. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, shit. So we're going through that whole process, you know, weigh them out, see what they are, what the weight loss is. Is it how I cleaned it? You know, I'm trying all the different techniques and skills and head on, head off, how big it is. But trying to figure that out as well. So.
No, it's important to understand variables, especially in like what we do, where we're educating the masses of users on what these things do and the ins and outs. We have to know this thing, you know, forward and back. And the only way you do that was experimentation, pushing the limits.
Yeah.
And I've noticed with these dry aging cabinets, you always have to go a little bit longer, right? Like, traditional dry aging cabinets back in the day, you probably didn't have as many controls. So things would happen faster because there was less boundaries. Now these are so highly tuned in. There's AI and algorithms in them now. So you don't have the chaotic environments occurring that used to happen and push things faster. You have very controlled environments, so things take a little bit longer.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sous-viding a steak. It takes a little bit longer to finish it, but you know, it's perfect in the end. You know, the first time you sous-vide something, it doesn't make sense. Especially when you learn how to grill traditionally. Like, it doesn't make sense. It's no different than that. Like, We just have to learn the new technologies and adapt them to the old ways, really.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, there's so much technology in the kitchen. I mean, all around us here. This I mean, it's just kitchen. It's just like kitchen tech mecca being around it all the time. But
yeah,
it's interesting to see. You could probably shed some light on this. Is the old guard, as I kind of call it, or right. I, you know, kind of because the shelf life of a chef is so short because of the abuse that's put on their bodies.
Oh, God,
right?
Yeah.
Between
yeah.
the diet, between the stress, between the extracurricular activities.
I'm 43 in human years and chef years, I'm 98 years old.
Right. Like, right. I got lucky. I got out fairly quick, especially of the harsh environments. Yeah. And I'm glad I did, being as tall as I am. My knees cannot handle,
oh,
you know.
Oh, yeah, no. And your back. Yeah.
And my back. You know, I have to play giraffe in the kitchen, you know, if I go someplace because the counters are the size of this table, you know, so I got to spread the legs just to cut it a decent height. Otherwise, I'm bent over, like, you know. Anyways.
Tall guy problems. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, tall guy problems. But is seeing, you know, I see a lot of older chefs having a hard time implementing this tech. They're so set. Exclusion of the top echelon who are always on track.
Yeah.
Right? I'm talking a lot of country club guys.
That upper echelon, though, has a lot of younger guys fueling that development. It's not their call. I'm going to throw light on this. I've been in a lot of those Michelin kitchens. The hallmarks of those kitchens maintain what made them famous. The new blood in those kitchens is what gives you the innovations you see coming out of those kitchens, typically. You know, for 7 out of 10 of those kitchens, that's how it goes. So, like, the old guard is the old guard, from my experience. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you have that closed off chef that doesn't want to learn new things. They don't want to adopt new technologies because they don't understand, right? And they never bothered to learn during that movement that happened. Like any of my mentors and up, they're very, very guarded and put off to any sort of technology. And then you have the guys who it clicks with, the old guard. And then they're still resistant to it because they're like, it's taking away jobs, right? But think about our industry and what's happening.
Not enough people. Hope you enjoyed part one of my conversation with Dustin, getting into Koji, dry aging, and the culture shift happening in the kitchen. But next week, we take a turn. Dustin gets real about burnout, stepping away from the grind, and how he's rebuilding a career and a life that looks very different from the one he started in. See you next week for the second course.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.